Siena in my undergraduate days. I'll probably never be able to afford the hardy Brunellos. Check them out next time you're in a nice wine shop. I usually spend less than $10 a bottle and never more than $20. But one wine from the Monsanto vineyards in Tuscany appealed to me especially. It is the wine we bought for our wedding more than 30 years ago. When I started making the effort to have a bottle of wine around, I remembered the label. It has no connection to the Monsanto Corporation, in case you are wondering. I found it at the wine library in Short Hills, New Jersey, and bought a bottle for about $17. It was as good as I remembered, and it gave me a great feeling to drink something that brought such sweet memories. It got a decent rating from Robert Parker, depending on the year, but nothing to jump at. Armed with my financial acumen on my most recent visit, I told the clerk I'd like to buy a case of the Monsanto. They were pushing case price discounts, with big signs explaining the math on selected vintages. The clerk called downstairs for a case of the 2010. When it was hauled up to the checkout, I asked what the case discount was. "There's no case discount with this one," the clerk told me. Well, damn. I bought it anyway. Yes, I was a little reluctant to walk away after putting them to the trouble of lugging it up. I'm polite, okay? But I also figured that I'd buy plenty of wine from them at $10 and even $4 a bottle, a tasty red table wine that's as good as some of the Chiantis they sell for much more. And if they raised the price later, I'd have beaten inflation. Jean convinced me that I made the right choice. It's a wine I can bring to friends' homes for dinners, and it will be there whenever I want a bottle. It will be nice to have it around. I'll try for a discount next time. Life is long. At least I hope it is. After Tobias, I moved on to another classic, The Money Game, by Adam Smith, the pen name for George J.W. Goodman. This is another of those revered works that has sent a lot of people down the road to financial independence. He has updated it since the first edition came out in 1967, when its frank recognition of the craziness of markets set it apart from the other go-go guides to wealth. It's been a long-time bestseller for a reason, and not just because the author was the host of Adam Smith's Money World on PBS. Lucid explanations of the financial world meet up in these pages with a literary sensibility that can be startlingly effective, as when he explains what happens when a bullish stock market collapses. We are all at a wonderful party, and by the rules of the game, we know that at some point in time, the Black Horseman will burst through the great terrace doors to cut down the revelers. Those who leave early may be saved, but the music and wines are so seductive that we do not want to leave. But we do ask, what time is it? What time is it? Only none of the clocks have any hands. Good stuff. This book provides real insight about the ways that Wall Street works and market timing and mass psychology. He freely admits that playing the market is a game and that only a gambler can find it compelling. If you are a successful game player, it can be a fascinating, consuming, totally absorbing experience. In fact, it has to be, he writes. If it is not totally absorbing, you are not likely to be among the successful, because you are competing with those who do find it so absorbing. That's an important warning. The book's a gem, but the latest version came out in 1976, shortly after the birth of index funds and the vast changes they brought to the market. Index funds allow you to do well at the game without the gambler's instinct. So this one can feel dusty. But for people who do want a better sense of the market, and who do want to develop a strategy for investing, The Money Game continues to stand out. Bonus. Another relatively ancient book for those who really want to pursue an active investment path is Benjamin Graham's classic, The Intelligent Investor, published in 1949. Graham wrote the Bible of what is known as value investing, the method of finding undervalued stocks that has been followed by Warren Buffett to great success. Buffett says it is by far the best book on investing ever written. And who am I to argue with him? The next book I tried was from one of the best-loved personal finance writers out there, Dave Ramsey. He is an advice machine. You can hear his reassuring folksy Tennessee accent on radio, or pick up tips on his popular website, or read any of his many books. Wherever you find him, his basic message is super simple. Debt is the enemy. Get out of debt. That is the message of Ramsey's Total Money Makeover, a proven plan for financial fitness. I find it hard to argue with that basic thought, and many people find his step-by-step plans to reduce debt and build wealth very appealing. His big idea is the debt snowball, a simple and psychologically satisfying way to pay down debt. Many economists will tell you to pay off the debts with the highest interest rate first. Ramsey tells you to list your debts from the smallest to the largest, and start working your way up from the little stuff. The reason has less to do with economics than with psychology. You will see your progress as you knock out the smaller debts, and that will give you the morale boost to keep at it and go after the bigger ones. When you start the debt snowball and in the first few days pay off a couple of little debts, trust me, it lights your fire, he writes. And getting fired up is super important. He also offers workbooks and financial peace budgeting software. The book is friendly, but strict, with helpings of scripture and preaching. When Ramsey tells us the debt snowball is easy to understand but requires truckloads of effort, he recalls the words of his pastor, who said that living right isn't complicated, but it's difficult. Ramsey has his critics. His blinding success has spawned a mini-industry of Dave doubters, who point out that not all debt is bad, and that borrowed money can be used to make money, and that Ramsey's methods are needlessly strict. You can read more of the criticism at sites like The White Coat Investor, where it's argued that when it comes to investing, Ramsey gives terrible advice. Mr. White Coat, whose real name is James M. Dahl, seems a little dogmatic to me, but I do have problems with Ramsey's stern attitude about making and keeping a family budget, which I'll be talking more about in the chapter on debt. The next volume on my list, The Little Book of Common Sense Investing by John Bogle, the former chief executive of the Vanguard Group, which he founded in 1974. Over the years, he's achieved well-deserved guru status and has written his own shelf of books. I'll be talking a lot more about Bogle in coming pages because he revolutionized investing through his development of low-cost index funds. But if you want to know more than this little book will tell you about his investing philosophy, you could do a lot worse than to go to the man himself. It's all here. The admonition to avoid picking individual stocks, or working with brokers who want you to trade and churn and trade your way to riches. He writes, "The way to wealth for those in the business is to persuade their clients, don't just stand there, do something. But the way to wealth for their clients in the aggregate is to follow the opposite maxim. Don't do something, stand there." Buy and hold is his mantra, and index funds, with their low fees, are his tonic. Bogle is the debunker's debunker, genial on the page, but burning with outrage over the ways that the financial industry exploits its customers. He is also taken with certain phrases, like former Supreme Court Justice Louis Brandeis's observation that speculative crazes fall to the relentless rules of humble arithmetic, which comes up in the text more than a dozen times. His writing style is simple and straightforward. He's a no-bull kind of guy. He writes that his detractors say all he has going for him is the uncanny ability to recognize the obvious. But don't believe it. Often, nothing is less obvious than the obvious, especially when there are whole industries built on trying to make things seem complicated. So when he says that the message of his book is little more than common sense, It should remind us all how uncommon common sense can be. Speaking of simplicity and common sense, it would be hard to beat Helene Olin, a writer on personal finance and other topics. She and Harold Pollack, a public policy professor at the University of Chicago, have written a tremendous book about investing that's hype-free and simple down to its bones. The Index Card: Why Personal Finance Doesn't Have to Be Complicated. Their basic point is that you can, and should, boil your financial goals down to a single index card, as Pollack did during a video interview with Olin in 2013, a moment that led to this book. And the advice is good. Pollack's own index card has 9 points, including put as much money as you can into low-cost index funds, pay off credit cards, don't buy individual stocks, save hard, and make any financial advisor you deal with commit to the fiduciary standard. Of course, you might ask, if everything Pollack needed to say could be boiled down to an index card, why read a 240-page book? Pollack explained this, wittily, to the financial journalist Penny Wang, in an article in Money. Even the Ten Commandments needed some backup material. And that backup material includes a lot of the same basic information about investing that the other folks listed here provide. The stuff like telling you the difference between a mutual fund and an exchange-traded fund. And it adds some things that didn't fit on the original card, including insurance and buying a home. They refuse to follow the convention of the personal finance genre that tries to make the world of money seem like a dark and mysterious thicket that only they can guide you through. They demystify finance. So, here it is. Okay, so I did it. I read a stack of books to see whether there is a trick, a knack, that can help people like us, mere mortals, beat the market. It led me to a stunning conclusion. No. A lot of books insist that they offer the secret, but the only real secret is that there is no secret. Many of these books offer common sense and humor, but they will not make you rich. All this means that you will not learn how to pick individual stocks from me, no matter which financial guides I've read. Here is the not-so-magic formula. Don't even try to pick individual stocks, and be wary of mutual funds that try to pick a basket of stocks for you. As I've mentioned, managed funds tend to have high fees. Instead, focus on those index funds that have low fees and track the market. You could stop listening now. Here endeth the lesson. But don't you want to know why index funds are the main investment you want? As Pollack put it, there's backup material. First, the caveat. There are, of course, people who do become fabulously wealthy through their investments, people like Warren Buffett. Buffett, as you surely know, is the oracle. Just think what you could have done if you had grabbed his coattails early on and bought a share of Berkshire Hathaway. Between 1964 and 2014, the per-share market value of the stock jumped by 1,826,163%. The entry cost is a little high, though. At this writing, a single share costs about $220,000. And while I hope that he and his genius live forever, the actuarial tables suggest that an 86-year-old man is not going to have another 50-year run. His acolytes are, no doubt, very smart. But they aren't Warren Buffett. What about the rest of us? You and me and all the other mere mortals. Take just a moment. Press pause. Look in a mirror. I'll wait. Welcome back. Did you see Warren Buffett in the mirror? I thought not. I didn't see him in mine either. I long ago realized I'm not the kind of person likely to become a market maven. I can't bear watching financial gurus like Jim Cramer, who shouts and touts across the airwaves. I visited online investment forums with people who eat, sleep, and breathe trading. But I might as well have dropped into a chat about quantum physics or pro football. I really am an idiot when it comes to sports. How long ago did I realize that I was not going to rule Wall Street? It was soon after my 13th birthday, in 1970. You know, back when we rode our pet dinosaurs to school. Around that time, I thought that I had a good shot at becoming a financial wizard. My plan was simple. After my bar mitzvah, I took some of the money that people had handed me in envelopes at the reception and decided to parlay it to riches in the stock market. Investing, I figured, would start me on my road to adulthood. Today, I am a man, with a brokerage account. I knew what to invest in. IBM. Computers were the future. My research into the stock tables and the Galveston Daily News showed me that the computer company, like most tech stocks, had been enjoying a climb like a Saturn V rocket muscling its way toward the moon. The Apollo program was even using IBM computers to get the Apollo astronauts to the moon. How could I go wrong buying IBM? So I bought a share. Or maybe two. Big investor. Each share cost more than $100. Soon after my purchase, that rocketing stock turned around and became a lawn dart. My personal piece of IBM lost 42% of its value during that first month. Shares were being squeezed in what would later be known as the Earth Day crash of tech stocks, which coincided with the very first Earth Day. I did not understand those larger trends and forces. What I did know was that getting rich in the stock market no longer seemed like a sure thing. I followed the share price for a while with a sick feeling in my belly. Should I sell? Even at 13, I knew that only fools sell at the bottom. I'd lost money on paper, but it might turn around. Selling at the bottom would make the loss official. But was it the bottom? Selling and shifting the money into a hotter stock might get me something. But I was no longer sold on my brilliance as a stock picker. I held on to my chunk of IBM and gradually forgot that I owned it. I had bought it with easy money, and then, as now, I had a pretty short attention span. I got back to schoolwork, playing with my desktop model Tesla coil, and wondering if I was ever going to go on a date. There is probably a good scientific paper to be written about the inverse relationship between being the kind of kid who owns a Tesla coil and his likelihood of dating anytime soon. But that is a project for another day. I figured that the stock would recover, or it wouldn't. Eventually, the price did rise a bit, and I sold my shares without a big gain or loss. I didn't take another look at the stock tables or put money into the market until I kicked off my 401k nearly 15 years later. Part of growing up is figuring out which things you are best at and which you might as well leave to others. Being a financial genius is not one of my gifts. Over time, I realized I was pretty good at other things. Astonishingly, I'm able to make a living out of hammering out words into sentences, and sentences into paragraphs, a process that my friend David Carr called treating my keyboard as an ATM. So my lack of financial acumen is not a source of shame, especially since very few of us are likely to climb to wealth by picking individual stocks. To put it biblically, and why not, none of us has the Urim and Thummim. Those are, the Old Testament tells us, stones that could be consulted for answers to thorny questions. They were connected to a fashion item known as the high priest's breastplate. And it's all pretty complicated and, frankly, a little comic booky. From the moment I first read about them, I was hooked on the idea. If I had those, I figured, I probably could pick the stocks that could beat the market. Big if, though. Like the Ark of the Covenant at the end of Raiders of the Lost Ark, the Urim and Thummim are probably sitting in a cavernous federal warehouse somewhere. A few years ago, I went looking for the magical doodads for my humor column. I figured they would most likely be in the hands of the one person who most often seemed to make the right financial decisions, and who also had the money to buy truly priceless objects. Warren Buffett. I called Omaha. A woman with a friendly and professional voice answered the phone at Mr. Buffett's office. I explained that I was a reporter from the New York Times, and that I was searching for the Urim and Thummim. "I don't even know what you're referencing," she said. "No problem. Not everybody is up on Old Testament lore, even in Omaha." I tried explaining what the Urim and Thummim were. This didn't seem to help, and her tone went from confused to cool. I asked her name. "I don't think I'm going to tell you," she said. Could she at least let me know if Mr. Buffett might have left the Urim and Thummim just, you know, lying around? "I'm going to have to let you go, sir. Thank you." And with that, you might find this hard to believe, she hung up on me. I didn't even get to ask whether Mr. Buffett's co-oracle, Charles T. Munger, had them. This oracle business is tougher than it looks. Let's not kid ourselves about the potential for total human transformation here. The people who do well in the market are very focused on money and investing. They work at techniques like finding bargains in the market valuation of individual stocks and hitting the right timing to buy and sell. They follow procedures laid out by geniuses like Benjamin Graham and his previously mentioned theory of value investing. Finding companies that are intrinsically worth more than their stock value would indicate. They are Adam Smith's players of the game. These people use a lot of their brain space to play this game, and some of them, I'm sure, do well. More of them do not. Even professional money managers don't beat the market all the time. Nobody's got the Urim and Thummim. And so we're back to that biggest, truest secret that I've encountered, underscored by Bogle and Buffett and the rest. The average investor does best by starting early in life and by buying low-fee funds that reflect the overall market, known as index funds. While beating the market is hard, matching the market is easy. What's more, the market tends to rise over time. Meanwhile, avoiding the fees associated with buying and selling individual stocks or investing in managed funds puts most people in a better position than those who churn and look for the trick that will make them rich. The far lower fees for index funds make a difference. Standard & Poor's does a report it calls the Persistence Scorecard, which tracks the performance of mutual funds. Over a 5-year period, the company found that fewer than 1/3 of 1% of 664 stock funds stayed in the top quarter of performance. None of the funds for companies with mid-size and small market capitalization, that is, the value of all their shares, made it through the 5 years consistently on top. Wow, right? The problem is that stock prices are not, in practice, predictable. They follow what financial journalist Burton Malkiel called a random walk. I called Malkiel, whose 1973 book, A Random Walk Down Wall Street, is an investing classic, and witty too. "Stock picking just plain doesn't work," he told me. I was the one who sort of jokingly said, "You might as well throw darts at the stock page, because you'll pick your stocks as well that way as any other way." In fact, you can't even do that anymore, because newspapers don't print all the stock prices. But you get the idea. Nobody outdoes the market consistently, and if they claim to, well, the person who comes to mind is Bernie Madoff. "If something is too good to be true, it probably is," Malkiel said. He, too, is a fan of index funds. "Picking individual stocks as a solo investor," he said, "is not likely to do better than an index fund. Some investors accept the idea that they aren't going to be brilliant stock pickers, but that they believe in relying on other smart people, professional fund managers, to make the money for them. Instead of picking the horse, the stock, they pick the jockey, the professional fund manager. But the record of the pros is not consistently great either. When I told Malkiel about my choice of index funds based on my lack of confidence as an investor, he scoffed. "In fact, it's not simply for financial idiots," he said. "It's the thing to do for the most advanced investor." And he said the lower fees on index funds make the argument even stronger. "The only thing I could tell you that I am absolutely 100% sure of is the bigger fee I pay to the purveyor for any investment service, the less there will be for me." We had warmed up, so I asked him the big question that had been hanging over my head like a cloud since my conversation with the Vanguard broker. Did I need to rebalance my portfolio to include more bonds? I told him that it seemed to me that if I were about to retire, that was a good idea. But I expected to be around for a while. The country, he believes, is headed into a period of poor returns on stocks and on bonds. But even so, he said, the notion that loading up on bonds in your 50s is misguided. "I think the sort of traditional advice of you need a lot of bonds is wrong," he said. "And it's also wrong for somebody in their 50s, because it isn't the case anymore that you retire at 65 and then you die the next year or two. Life expectancy has increased dramatically." "If you invest in stocks," he explained, "you should have a long horizon to ride the ups and downs, which is what somebody in his 50s has," he said. "Maybe 35 years until the curtain falls." I told him about having attended my dad's 90th birthday party. I told him about dad's 2 heart attacks, 2 strokes, brain surgery, diabetes, high blood pressure, and how he was preparing to work the next session of the Texas legislature as a lobbyist, something he had been doing since the 1980s when he left elected politics. "He is the Terminator," I told Mr. Malkiel, "and I believe that he could still kick my ass." He laughed. "That's wonderful." He was speaking from the vantage point of being in his 80s himself. "That's why I wouldn't worry about being a little overexposed to equities," he said. "I think it's the right answer." Validated by a big market expert. Now that's a good day. By the way, a few months after I interviewed Mr. Malkiel, he told my colleague James B. Stewart that he had reconsidered the idea that experts and stock pickers can't beat index funds. He had modified his view to accept the idea that sophisticated algorithms running fast computer-based trading and known as smart beta can beat index funds, at least modestly, but that he still remains a fan of index investing for the most part and for most investors. Not everyone buys the idea that index funds are the way to go. I once interviewed Mark Cuban by email about investing. The star of Shark Tank, a billionaire and serial entrepreneur, answers his own email, astonishingly enough. I was writing another one of my columns and decided to ask him for advice about how to join the 1%. His answer was pretty clearly typed in a hurry, probably with his thumbs. But he told me that I was going about things all wrong. "Easy answer. Stop investing in mutual funds and depending on some kid in a gerbil cage running and trying to get ahead of his or her peers, and instead pay off all of your debt, including your credit cards, and invest in yourself. No one ever got rich depending on someone who got hired to be fired." His suggestion was, unsurprisingly, what made him rich. Entrepreneurship. Even his answer was entrepreneurial. Invest in yourself and start a business built around something you are great at, and you have a chance to hit the 1%. Invest in an index fund, you have no chance. And spend the $3 to read this book. And then an Amazon link to buy How to Win at the Sport of Business. If I Can Do It, You Can Do It, by Mark Cuban. That's right. He pitched me his self-published book on investing. He never stopped selling. And he said, that's the kind of entrepreneurship that could work for writers like me. Whipping together ebooks that you can sell for $3 a pop is quick, easy, and a way to build a business that even reporters may be able to excel at. Oof. He's right about the credit cards, of course, and entrepreneurship has worked spectacularly well for him. And it's the message of popular personal finance writers like Kiyosaki. But would it have worked for me? His financial philosophy glosses over the risks of failure in the entrepreneurial path. About half of new businesses go bust within 5 years. Only a third survive to 10 years, according to the Small Business Administration. And if I know me, and you know me pretty well by now, the half I'd end up in isn't really in doubt. I'm glad I've stuck with index funds. They might not make me rich, but they are likelier to make me comfortable and less likely to make me lose it all on a crapshoot. Thanks to index funds, the nature of the investing game has changed from a casino to something more like a video game. You can run up the points, sure, but the real goal is to survive. Index funds weren't always with us. A little history. So, where did index funds come from? They have a father, and his name is John C. Bogle. Let's go a little deeper into the history. Bogle recognized early on that we are not soothsayers. Even the very smart people who consider themselves able to beat the market can't do it consistently, and the rest of us don't stand a chance. If we sit down at the poker table, we are the marks, the chumps, the inevitable losers. As the supercomputer says at the end of War Games, the only winning move is not to play. I called up Mr. Bogle to ask about all this, and he couldn't have been nicer. He no longer runs the Vanguard Group, but at 87 years old, and more than 20 years after a heart transplant, he's still a super sharp, folksy guy. Bogle told me he came up with the idea of the first index fund in 1974. He had tried the managed fund business, becoming the head of Wellington Management, and trying to beat the market. "It's not easy to do. This is a hard business," he told me. He engineered a merger that turned out badly and ran after go-go stocks during a hot market, and it all went bad when the market turned bearish. His partners at Wellington fired him. Out of that failure came one of the great business successes of history, based on a simple fact. A fund that does well for a while will head south when conditions change, and conditions inevitably change. In terms of statistical probability, there's the problem of reversion to the mean. Nobody is on top forever, and things tend to drift back toward the center of the pack, and some will dive past the middle toward the bottom. The last shall be first, and the first shall be last, he said in our interview, deftly paraphrasing the book of Matthew. In a set of story decisions that completely reshaped the investing world, Bogle decided to find a way to run a fund that slashed the costs of doing business. Those costs included all that expensive research. He talked the Wellington board into letting him create what would become known as the Vanguard 500 Index Fund, based on a package of stocks that reflected the overall field. Instead of trying to be a stock picker and to outperform the market, Bogle simply wanted to match it and watch the rest of the fund managers fly high, crash, and then trade places with each other again. The savings in research and management could be passed on to investors, who would see their dollars work even harder. He started the fund in 1976, and with precious few investors. He had hoped to kick off the fund with $150 million. He initially raised just $11.3 million. It was a complete flop, he recalled. The fund got a nickname, Bogle's Folly. The idea must have seemed crazy at the time. Actually, the financial journalist Jason Zweig recently wrote, "It was close to being considered just plain nuts." Swashbuckling fund managers, often called gunslingers, roamed the markets in the late 1960s and early 1970s. In 1968, several go-go funds had earned returns in excess of 100%. They were heroes. But Bogle has research to back up his belief in index funds. He was emboldened by the writings of the Nobel laureate economist Paul A. Samuelson, who had called for the creation of something like index funds in a now-famous 1974 essay. Just 4 pages long, the essay advocated for a portfolio that tracks the S&P 500 index. In a later essay, Bogle said this amazingly feisty article struck him like lightning. His plan for a low-cost fund would go perfectly with a strategy focused on index funds, even as love and marriage go together like a horse and carriage. Samuelson had tough words for fund managers. Perhaps there really are managers who can outperform the market consistently. Logic would suggest that they exist, but they are remarkably well hidden. He really took the gloves off in that essay, arguing, "But a respect for evidence compels me to incline toward the hypothesis that most portfolio decision-makers should go out of business, take up plumbing, teach Greek, or help produce the annual GNP by serving as corporate executives." Ouch. Get some ointment for that burn, fund managers. Naturally, the culture of the gunslinger rejected the new index funds with scorn. Stock pickers had a vested interest in running it down, and the companies threatened by the new business model insisted that it enshrined mediocrity. No swagger, no glory. That argument made intuitive sense to people who thought money managers were geniuses, Bogle said. And so it was easy to see why no one would want to invest in mediocrity. That is, until they find out the alternative is worse than mediocrity. And in a lot of cases, a lot worse. One brokerage firm went on a full-scale attack, publishing a poster exhorting Americans to help stamp out index funds, and screaming in all capital letters, "Index funds are un-American." Some writers have suggested the attacks were tongue-in-cheek, but they seem pretty desperate to me. And whether they were serious or not, the logic of index investing became evident. From that initial $11 million in assets in 1975, index investing jumped to $511 million by 1985. 10 years later, it was $868 billion. By 2016, it stood at $4 trillion. "Index funds," Bogle told me, "are eating up the world." Vanguard has won. It is the world's largest fund company, with total assets of $3.6 trillion, with a T. And all because he got fired. The index method still has critics. In August 2016, a research note from Sanford C. Bernstein and Company, the research and brokerage firm, said that the passive investing of index funds is worse than Marxism, which doesn't sound like sour grapes at all. But the more common view is that John Bogle has made investing safer and more profitable for us all. It's not just individual investors who can do better with low-cost index funds. In 2016, Little Houghton College in Western New York State made more than 7.5% on its investments in the calendar year. Harvard, by comparison, lost 2%. The difference? Ivy League schools like Harvard tend to manage their endowments actively and in fancy ways, with hedge funds and the like. Houghton has been moving more and more into index funds with lower management costs and better returns. We should all be as smart as Houghton. Or as smart as Warren Buffett. In his 1996 letter to shareholders, he wrote, "Let me add a few thoughts about your own investments. Most investors, both institutional and individual, will find that the best way to own common stocks is through an index fund that charges minimal fees. Those following this path are sure to beat the net results, after fees and expenses, delivered by the great majority of investment professionals." Buffett has even put down an enormous bet on the proposition. As he described the history of the wager in his 2016 letter to stockholders, he offered $500,000 to prove that no investment professional, investing $1 million in any 5 hedge funds, would earn more over 10 years than the same amount invested in the S&P 500 basket of stocks. After 2 years of no-takers, a hedge fund guy, Ted Seides, stepped up, and the prize was set at $1 million to go to a charity of the winner's choosing. In mid-2017, months before the bet came due, Seides admitted defeat and paid up, though he has said that he believes the S&P is somewhat overpriced now and that if he doubled down for another 10 years, he would have greater than even odds victory. Maybe. Today, John Bogle is considered one of the heroes of business, with a fervent following of investors who call themselves Bogleheads. They have discussion forums and everything. I don't spend much time in financial discussion forums because they make my brain hurt, but the Bogleheads tend to be knowledgeable and friendly. In a 2014 essay, Mr. Bogle estimated that the combination of total cost of managed funds and the better performance of index funds over time translates into a startling 65% more money in retirement for the index investors. By 70, someone who had started investing at 30 and stuck with index funds would have $927,000 to show for it. A neighbor who stuck with actively managed funds, Bogle wrote, would end up with a much less comfortable $561,000 to $366,000 less, in fact. Learning those statistics made me wonder where I'd have been if I'd gone all in with index funds from the beginning of my investment career. While I was writing this chapter, I looked back through my Vanguard portfolio and moved all the shares I'd had in something called the T. Rowe Price Institutional Large Cap Core Growth Fund into a Vanguard Index Fund. Still learning. Anyway, back to my conversation with Bogle. I told him about the book project, about shaping up our financial lives at this late date. He asked how old I am. 59, I said. You're a kid, man, he responded. That was encouraging. When I told him that Gene and I had been quietly putting away savings since our 30s, but rarely looked at the performance of the funds, he approved. Don't peek. That's one of my most important rules. I blurted out, you saved my life. You'd be surprised how many people tell me that, he said. We've had very good markets, and I've made sure you got your fair share of the returns. But what about people like some of the readers of this book? I asked him. People who haven't been putting much away, if anything, and who now might be in their 50s. A comfortable retirement, even if saving begins now, would be very hard to achieve, no? Get going anyway, he said. Even if you can't get all the way there, it would only be a very foolish person who would say, I'd have to put half of my salary away every month. I can't do that, so I'll do nothing. Obviously, he acknowledged, some people aren't in a position to save. And if you can't do it, you can't do it. But if you can put away 15% of your income, you'll get part of the way there, and you'll have some kind of nest egg when you get through. Doing nothing, he told me, provides an absolute guarantee that you'll wind up with nothing. What about the future? The world keeps throwing changes our way. David Bowie, gone. Prince. And John Glenn, all in the same rotten year, 2016. In 2017, Tom Petty and Fats Domino, Edith Windsor, Jonathan Demme, and Mary Tyler Moore. That kind of change hurts your heart, but not your portfolio. A change in presidencies, however, can cost you, having far-reaching effects on the economy, on the stock and bond markets, and on the safety net that helps the less fortunate weather personal crises. And so, speaking of chaos, what are we to make of Donald Trump? A friend at work told me that the day after the election, he put his entire pension into cash. That is, stable money market accounts with almost zero income, but tremendous stability. He was expecting a quick economic collapse with the new president. That hasn't happened, so far. At least. And stocks continued to rise. He recently told me he's thinking of putting his money back into stocks. One of the smartest personal finance writers I know, Penelope Wang, banged out a smart column the day after the presidential election with the headline, "No matter what Trump does, keep your hands off your 401k. In the piece, she pointed out, when nervous investors respond to the latest news or market twitches, they often get it wrong. But she also warned that anyone nearing retirement should be looking for a portfolio balance that isn't heavily weighted towards stocks. Upping the bonds. Worrying about Trump, she wrote, provides a good excuse to check that stock-to-bonds blend. She isn't the only expert telling investors to keep calm and carry on. In January 2017, just before the inauguration of Donald Trump, Warren Buffett gave an interview to the financial network CNBC. He spoke optimistically about markets and investing, though admitted he did not know what might happen over the next couple of years. "There will be hiccups from time to time in the economy," he said, "but we'll do well over time." Even though he had supported Hillary Clinton for president, he said the United States has the secret sauce for long-term success, even though it doesn't work all the time perfectly. For long-term investing, he said, never bet against America. I really hope that he has the Urim and Thummim. Guess I'll stick it out with my current asset mix. After all, if the worst fears about Mr. Trump play out, in the resulting economic devastation, no amount of money short of private compound prepper wealth will do any of us much good. And if they don't, I might as well continue to ride the ride. Punch list. Taking stock of your portfolio. 1. Know yourself. Socrates was right. Get ready for your own financial journey by knowing what you know and who you are when it comes to money. Gene and I took FINRA's financial literacy quiz. You can too, at usfinancialcapability.org. Come on, it's only 5 questions. There's a 6th bonus question. Remember, 61% of respondents were unable to answer more than 3 of the 5 questions correctly. So don't feel bad if you miss a couple. That's why you're listening to this book, after all. 2. Check your risk tolerance. Now that you know where you stand, check out your own tolerance for financial risk. There are many such quizzes, and they are readily Googleable. I recommend the one developed by Ruth Litton of Virginia Tech and John Grable at the University of Georgia. It's 13 questions, and your answers help further their research. No personally identifiable information is recorded. You can find it at njaes.rutgers.edu/money/risk-quiz. 3. Now check your funds. Enough with the quizzes. If you have a 401k or an IRA, check the funds you are invested in. What's your ratio of stocks to bonds? I think most people would be more receptive to the traditional ratio of stocks to bonds than I am. The basic idea is that younger investors should have an asset mix that's very high in stock funds, since they tend to grow quickly. And in the long term, the ups and downs of the market smooth out. As we age, the thinking goes, we need more conservative investments so that our portfolios don't take a hit so close to retirement that they can't recover. The old rule of thumb is that the percentage of your portfolio that should be invested in stocks is 100 minus your age. So at the age of 50, the rule goes, half of your investments should be in stocks. Since we're living longer, among other reasons, these days, a lot of the retirement mutual funds choose a ratio that's more closely based on 120 or even 125 minus your age. By that reckoning, at 50, your portfolio should be composed of 75% stocks and 25% bonds. So now take what you've learned about yourself from the financial risk quiz and apply it to what you've learned about the market and your portfolio. If you came out as kind of a swashbuckler, you might keep yourself heavy in stocks longer. If you are more averse to risk, you'll have more bonds and even more stable places to park your cash, such as money market funds. Check the costs of fiddling. Vanguard, for example, charges you nothing if you are shifting money from one fund to another within its stable. And, like much of the rest of the investing population, keep your fees low by investing in low-cost index funds. 4. Up your funds. If we were perfect in a world of angels, we'd all max out our 401k contributions. Few people can afford to start out at that rate. But what you can probably do is up your contribution by just 1 percentage point of your income. Unless you are truly scraping by, it's not a huge sacrifice. But in the long run, it can make an enormous difference in your retirement account. So add that point. Next year, up it again. Chapter 4. Getting Advice. Now that you've listened to the previous chapter, you know a few things about investing. I hope that you're even ready to manage your investments. Or if you are going to not peek, as John Bogle suggests, you'll be able to keep those eyes shut with confidence after having set up the kind of portfolio that will do a good job of growing over time. Does that mean you can handle all of this on your own? You might be able to, sure. Or you might want advice. After all, I sought the advice of that nice guy from Vanguard, whose services I enjoyed at no charge. And there are lots of people who would be only too happy to advise you, and to be paid for their services, whether through commissions or fees. I figure that my Vanguard guy and I have an open relationship. If I wanted to see other advisors to find out how others might approach my financial future, he would understand. You know, if you love something, set it free and whatnot. What might those other advisors have to say about how we've structured our retirement plan? Would they say we were on track? Would they try to move us out of our Vanguard walled garden? I started looking around. To get a sense of the range of options, I sought help from two types of sources, from brokers and from full-fledged financial advisors. I also looked for the different ways they tend to make money. Fee-based consulting versus selling on commission. While my visits with these professionals weren't exhaustive, they can give a sense of what you're in for out there. Why getting advice could be a good idea. Let me start out by saying that it makes sense to seek smart financial advice. We have a pro do our taxes. Accountants know the right questions to ask and the pitfalls of tax form preparation. Even though, when we sit with our accountant, he fills in an online form based on a worksheet he's had us fill out, he's asking expert questions the whole way. Our previous accountant, a great guy who had a poster of Che Guevara on his office wall, would argue with me over the numbers I'd put down. "What? You didn't buy books for research? Come on," he'd say, coaxing me along as he would a slow child. And then he'd put down several $100s in book purchases. He retired, and I miss his avuncular prodding. Those questions, asked by a human being, make a difference. You might be the kind of person who can do your own taxes. Many of my friends do. You have my admiration. Even when I tried to fill out the relatively straightforward tax form for my daughter some years back, before her marriage, I ended up crazed with frustration, and still got the figures wrong. She got a nice note from the IRS, and a refund. We also looked to professional help to finally write a will. We've always hired a realtor to help buy and sell houses. No FSBO for us. So why not for investments and retirement? Still, if buyer beware means anything, it's especially important in the investing world. There's good and bad advice out there, and the bad stuff can cost you dearly. My research has led me to be somewhat wary of stockbrokers for investment planning, as opposed to certified financial planners. There are many honorable people in the brokerage profession, but the bad apples are truly bad. I called up Reed C. Fraza, a financial planner in New Jersey, to ask about why somebody might want a planner as opposed to the free advice I got from Vanguard. He had gotten in touch with me after my retirement planning story came out in the Times, offering to show me the value of working with a certified financial planner. Not surprisingly, he told me that working with a financial planner and paying for the advice that you get is a good idea. What Vanguard is making available to people at that price point is certainly valuable, he told me. Lots of people have been poorly served by Wall Street. The problem is that while the Vanguard approach is much better than the traditional transactional type of delivery, by which he meant the hard sell, it is a pretty cursory type of planning, which he characterized as a telephone type of virtual relationship with an advisor who is working largely from a computer-generated financial evaluation. That made my interactions with the Vanguard advisor seem a little thin, a point that he then pressed. I'm sure you've interviewed people on the phone and in person. There's so much more nuance and information that you get face-to-face than you get talking on the phone. His work, he said, goes beyond retirement planning to encompass broader discussion of life and goals and things like that. It's much harder to do from a questionnaire. Writing a will? His colleagues will help you plan ahead for the visit with the lawyer, and even accompany you to the lawyer's office, streamlining the will writing process and saving the customer money in billed hours. Yes, he acknowledged, many people do fine investing on their own, but not that many. I'm a big believer in the 80-20 rule, he said, meaning that probably about 20% of the population is capable of learning enough about finance and devoting enough attention to it to do 80% as well as they might with a financial advisor. But 80% of the population is not going to have the interest or ability to do nearly as well as a financial advisor. And those people can really use somebody who can educate them and help them make financial and life decisions. Many of his clients, he said, shy away from thinking or talking about money, but will do extensive research to plan a vacation. But it's not cheap. For financial planning, his minimum fee is $5,000 a year. More if you want investment management as well. He and his staff make no commissions and receive no incentives from financial companies to push their products. They make their money as a percentage of clients' investable net worth, that is, excluding real estate. It's an expensive business to run. Members of his staff serve between 25 and 30 clients each. Typical brokers, he said, might have 150 clients. They make it work by doing less. His clients, he told me, have an average net worth of $1.8 million. I liked him, but I did not feel I could afford him. And now, here come the warnings. At some time or other, if you've ever bought or sold individual stocks, or tried to develop an investment plan, you might have dealt with a stockbroker, someone to help you plan your portfolio. And that person might have been smart, and certainly assured you that he or she had your best interests at heart, and was working for you. It wasn't true, or, at least, it was probably not required by law. At the risk of sounding all Occupy Wall Street here, let me point out that the investment community has never been about making you rich, or even comfortable. Setting aside the actual scoundrels, the idea in the investment community has always been to make themselves rich by making money off you, but without fleecing you so thoroughly that it would reflect poorly on them and hurt business. Michael Lewis wrote about that world in his best-selling Liar's Poker, about working as a bond salesman for a Wall Street firm in the go-go 80s. He tells the story of terrible rip-off investments he was told to push onto his own customers in investment houses. He recalls balking at burning a customer with whom he'd built a relationship just to help out a trader in his company. The trader had bought a bond that had gone sour and needed to dump it. Lewis writes that the trader told him that I needed to be more of a team player. I was tempted to ask, which team? This attitude is even more evident in the retail market, where people like us are less financially knowledgeable than Lewis's corporate clients were. This is not a new thought. When the writer Fred Schwed published a funny send-up of the financial world 6 decades ago, he opened